Do the first one. All right. The whole city celebrates when godly succeed. They shout for joy when the wicked die. Upright citizens are good for a city and make it prosper. But the talk of the wicked tears it apart. Without wise leadership, a nation falls. There is safety in having many advisors. A growing population is a king's glory. A prince without subject has nothing. Godlessness makes a nation great, but sin is a disgrace to any people. A king rejoices in wise servants, but is angry with those who disagree or disgrace him. The king speaks with the divine wisdom. He must never judge unfairly. The Lord demands accurate scales and balances. He sets the standards for fairness. A king detests wrongdoing, for his rule is built on justice. The king is pleased with words from righteous lips. He loves those who speak honestly. The anger of the king is a deadly threat. The wise will try to appease it. When the king smiles, there is life. His favor refreshes like a spring rain. When a king sits in judgment, he weighs all the evidence, distinguishing the bad from the good. A wise king scatters the wicked like wheat, then runs his threshing wheel over them. The Lord's light penetrates the human spirit, exposing every hidden motive. Unfailing love and faithfulness protect the king. His throne is made secure through love. The glory of the young is their strength. The gray hair of experience is the splendor of the old. Physical punishment cleanses away evil. Such discipline purifies the heart. When the godly are in authority, the people rejoice. But when the wicked are in power, they groan. A just king gives stability to his nation, but one who demands bribes destroys it. If a ruler pays attention to liars, all his advisors will be wicked. The poor and their oppressor have this in common. The Lord gives sight to the eyes of both. If a king judges the poor fairly, his throne will last forever. To discipline a child produces wisdom, but a mother is disgraced by an undisciplined child. When the wicked are in authority, sin flourishes, but the godly will live to see their downfall. Disciple your children, and they will give you peace of mind, and you will make your heart glad. When people do not accept divine guidance, they run wild, but whoever obeys the law is joyful. This is God's word.
All right. Thank you, Luke. Thank you, Roland and Tamet. Roland is a much more brave man than I, just to jump right into co-eternal with the kids. Man, I had prepared an alternate kids lesson in case you'd forgotten, and I wasn't going to go anywhere near that. So that's awesome. Thanks. I'll simply pray and say, may the words of my mouth and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. And acknowledge that we had a few proverbs up there that all had to do with authority, power. We've called the sermon this week Wisdom and Power and Public, and that's based off of some questions we got earlier in the year that people wanted wisdom on. They wanted wisdom around. There were a lot of political questions when we took questions earlier in the year, and so they wanted wisdom on authority and power. And you'll notice something in those proverbs that there's kind of a mix of things like kingship and parenting, and the Proverbs seem to kind of smash it all together. And we're going to look at some of that and consider how that works. Like, why are some of these concepts, there's statements about God, statements about kings, statements about families. Why are they all smashed together? But first of all, I'm going to tell you a little bit about my experience this week in Montgomery, Alabama, under the banner of Proverbs 29:2, when the godly are in authority, the people rejoice, but when the wicked are in power, they groan. So I spent Tuesday to Thursday in Montgomery. I am facilitating a small group of leaders this year who are trying to prepare for divisive political times. And so that's a thing, and I'm just kind of a Zoom facilitator for them, but they wanted to gather all of the people to meet each other in Montgomery. And Montgomery was a beautiful town. I was definitely very, treated very well there. This is the view from my hotel room, which is like, I don't know if you've ever gotten a hotel room and you realize there's four directions this thing faces, and one of them is going to be really nice and the others are going to be looking at buildings. Well, I got that this time. So it was pretty, pretty beautiful. I spent very little time in the South, personally, other than Florida. I've been to Florida a couple times for church stuff over the years. And this year I've been twice, right? I've been to Kentucky. I think I've told you about that. Kind of remote monastery, one of the oldest, I think it's the oldest monastery in the country. And this time to Montgomery, the capital of Alabama. And I really haven't spent much time in this part of the country. The activity of our cohort was to tour these new sites that have been opened up in the last, within the last about 8-10 years, that are at key locations in Montgomery that have to do with the civil rights movement, where a lot of America's power struggle, if you will, has played out. What are some key places in Montgomery? Well, this would be the church where Martin Luther King Jr. was first a pastor. And one of the surprises to me was that every time he would have walked out the door, he looked at the Capitol of Montgomery. I didn't realize it was a mere block away. And the white building just to the right is the offices, the political offices of the Capitol. They're right there. And on the Capitol steps is the statue to the Confederacy, to the leader of the Confederacy, still to this day, that he would have looked at every time he got out of church. And that's one of the things you see when you're just walking down Main Street of Montgomery. You learn about and see where the Montgomery bus boycott occurred, the Rosa Parks story, right? Where her refusal to give up a seat on the bus because the law now said that there was equality between the races, where her choice and the choice of others sparked a movement. And it was organized just down the street from King's Church, also in view of the Capitol of Montgomery. And it was organized in King's Church. During this time, King's house was bombed while his wife and kids were home. It was right down the street. We saw it. It's getting a new roof right now. Martin Luther King Jr.'s house is getting a new roof at the moment. That same Capitol is where the march from Selma to Montgomery, you might have heard of that and seen the famous images. So that's, if you look down into the left top of that image, that's the march from Selma to Montgomery when they finally reached the Capitol. There's King's Church right there, right next to it. And in this photo, Martin Luther King Jr. would be on the steps of the Capitol giving a speech. That march had come across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. There's famous video footage of that march where John Lewis and others are leading a group across, and they run into the deputies on the other side of that bridge and they are beaten back once they're asked to stop and assert that they have the right to walk across that bridge. They tried again, were stopped again, and a third time made the march to Montgomery. So all of that's happening right there. And just to illustrate again how close it all is, I took a walk on Thursday. I had 2 hours, 2 hours of total time in order, to see a couple of things we hadn't seen and to eat lunch. And I also wanted to see the Hank Williams Museum, because on top of being interested in the civil rights movement, I also like me some old country. So, 2 hours. So I took off, and I'd heard that the church where Jefferson Davis, leader of the Confederacy, the pastor there, had set him up as president, was down the street. It took me 5 minutes from the hotel to get there. I had my sandwich at a stop that was opened in 1901. It was a delicious Italian with banana pudding. That took me about 15 to 20 minutes. I walked for 5 more minutes. I'm at King's Church. The Capitol building is, of course, about 30 seconds away, as well as the offices. From there, I walked in approximately 3 minutes to the statue of Rosa Parks, which is where the bus depot was, where the all of this happened. And then in an approximate 5 more minutes, I was standing next to the Cadillac that Hank Williams died in the back of. This is all right there, right? Right there. And this very short walk exhibited something. Just how close the proximity of the key people and places of the civil rights struggle were to one another, right? They are literally right there. That power struggle was not something that was just, you know, happening. You know, people were far away and hearing rumors. I mean, this is people they knew and they saw walking to get a sandwich because the civil rights leaders and Hank Williams all went to the sandwich place where I went and the chili dog place I went that also opened in 1907. Okay. The reason that cohort is together, and I'm honored to help facilitate that, is they're trying to think through, you know, our contemporary day. And so we gathered at this these legacy sites to think through, especially, I mean, this was old history, but to think through how an era like the 60s that feels like it has a lot of similarity to today, what happened then and what we could learn from our history. We had an entire one day, wasn't enough, to pass through what's called the Legacy Museum there. And the first thing we were struck with as you walk in the Legacy Museum is there's just an ocean scene with faces. And you think about the transatlantic slave trade that brought Africans here. You think about all the people. You look at all these cities that took in slaves. We looked at Charleston. Charleston, South Carolina, 200,000 slaves were taken in at Charleston. 2 million of these people died in the ships. And because it's not good business to sort out dead things from living things, they were thrown into the ocean. We saw a document with a formal complaint by a citizen of Charleston, but not at the practice being ethical. It was about it being stinky. The stench of dead bodies washing up was becoming a real nuisance. And they were concerned about the health of their families because there were so many dead bodies getting caught in the trees. 2 million people died like that. The rest, when they got into places like Charleston, were stuffed into pens. And then they were washed. And then they were sold. We looked at signs, all the signs, and the advertisements in the paper. One of the signs that stuck out to me labeled for sale bucks and wenches. Bucks. If you were a man, that's you. You're a buck. And they described the bucks as strong and responsive to commands, just like you would describe an animal. These ads were run in the papers. The branding, incredible work put into the branding. Some of it looked like, you know, what a law office would do, or others, something you might see in a design magazine, because they were marketing these people to wealthy landowners. And they needed to capture their attention with really great images and get their attention so they'd come and buy from them. The wealthy stocked up on slaves on the East Coast, and eventually the big industry that began to boom was cotton in the South. And because of the rivers and a new technology, the steamboat started to ship slaves down to places like Montgomery. Montgomery became a hotbed for the purchasing of slaves. At one point, there were nearly, it was almost exactly 2/3 of Montgomery's citizens were slaves. So 1/3 of the people owned 2/3 of the people in Montgomery. Except, I said citizens, and they were not citizens. They were not considered citizens of that place. There's a wall and a sculpture park. So we got on a boat and we went down the Alabama River. And we thought about what it was like for families to get pieced apart, which they did. We heard ghosts speak. They had a setup where they had letters that were written, and we heard the voice over of the letters of what it was like for people to have their mom taken and shipped down the river, to have brother and sister split up and shipped down the river. A lot of people couldn't find each other. The only way they knew where the person was is they would find out the last name of the person who purchased them. So this wall commemorates the first time in the United States when African-Americans were considered African-Americans and given citizenship. This wall is huge. This wall is the last name of everybody who registered as a citizen that year. By huge, I mean my name, my family name's on there, which means Littletons, and there are about three different varieties of Littletons were slave owners, right? And my name was about eye high. Well, this wall was about 50, 60 feet high, two sides. People with my British last name held slaves. Oh, yeah, there it is, Littleton, right in the middle. And then from there, from that sculpture park, we went down to what's called the Memorial for Peace and Justice. This is the first one they built. This place is huge. That is a large structure. I took a picture of there. And it remembers that after the Emancipation Proclamation, post the era of slavery being legal, in which the South rejected integration. And that generally did happen. They blocked voting. We saw documents that you had to fill out in order to vote. If you were black, you got asked some questions, one of which was, how many bubbles are there in a bar of soap? Try to answer that. There were jars of jelly beans. You had to guess how many jelly beans were in the jar. If you got it right, you could vote that day. These are actual documents. So they'd been made citizens, but they couldn't vote. They couldn't ride the bus. They couldn't eat at the same restaurant. They couldn't drink from the same water. They couldn't swim in the same pool. So that started to be frustrating, right? And the people of some areas of the South, right, especially in Montgomery, didn't want that situation to change. So when something would happen, somebody would push back a little. There were a few things that happened. Here's a list of a couple. A white man offered a black man, to buy his cotton seed off of him. And the black man said, I think it's worth more than that. He killed him. It's called lynching. Another black man was viewed as not having a respectful tone. A lot of the lynchings went like this. Here's another example. A black man and a white woman were talking. The man passed her a note. White man saw it, apprehended him. No trial, nothing like that. It was pretty common for them to be hung and shot and burned. Sometimes one of the three, often all three. And what was the most gut-wrenching to see were the postcards that were sold after these events, usually for about 15 cents a piece, of hundreds of people around the body that they'd killed. And then they sold postcards. And almost uniformly, these folks were not held accountable or prosecuted. Many of them were prominent members of the community. The Monument for Peace and Justice remembers the lynchings with all of these hanging blocks of steel. There are thousands of them. And the thousands are not each one person. They're blocks of people killed in the same area, the ones who we have names for. And then there's a wall with water coming down for the thousands that were reported in no way at all. There's no way that my day of tourism gave me any inkling of the pain and devastation of this story, in which 15 million of the surviving blacks that came to America after they got across that ocean, who were brutally killed. 15 million. That is higher than the death toll of the Holocaust. That's the ones that made it across that ocean. There's no way for my day of tourism to get me anywhere near comprehending what happened. So why talk about it, right? It's just sad. Don't you all feel sad? What can we do? Well, I knew this trip was coming. I didn't know what it would be like. But I decided to talk about this piece of wisdom literature here after this trip, because when we think of power and we think of authority and we think of what the Bible has to say about it, I think it's healthy for us to think about real events that occurred. And many of them, because the segregation was going on into the 50s and 60s, and it's not exactly all over. Many of them affect humans we know right now. I'm going to tell you about a lady named Carolyn, who is one of our tour guides at the end. And her neighborhood was segregated when she was young. This is her life now. It's still impacting us. Okay? So when we think about these themes, I don't want us to be just super abstract. I want us to have something in mind today. So in the Proverbs, now we're going to hear some wisdom literature. And we're going to hold what I just talked to you about. Again, I have no clue what I'm talking about when it comes to that. I was there one day. You've heard me describe it in 5 to 10 minutes. We're going to do what we can with that, okay? We're going to talk about the locus of power. Where does it come from? What's its source? We're going to talk about what the foolish do with power, what the wise do with power. And, just contemplate what it can look like in public as a brief conclusion. Where does it come from? There's some simple concepts embedded across the story of the Bible, and they're almost hidden in plain sight. Proverbs 14:28 is an interesting example of this. A growing population is a king's glory. A prince without subjects has nothing. I tend to read that and think it's about the growing population. That's the thing that jumps out to me for whatever reason. Oh, he's got a growing population. But probably the word that should stand out most to us is the word glory, because that's a pretty heavy word. Literally heavy. The word means heavy. It's a weight. But it's a word that's almost always ascribed in the Bible to God, to Yahweh, the King of Israel, the creator in the whole story. Glory is an attribute of God's. So it's surprising for a king to be given that descriptor, glory. A person all throughout the Bible who has glory is mirroring God. A growing population is a king's glory because Yahweh is a creator who commanded people to be faithful or to be fruitful and multiply in the creation story. To have a growing population is to mirror that God of creation, that under his rule and blessing, there should be growth and a reign of goodness. So any king that has a growing population, in a little sense, mirrors Yahweh. Key to this piece of wisdom is that a king is to seek glory. But glory must be defined in relation to God. Think about it this way. What's the flip side? Anything ungodly is not glory. Any power that is ungodly is not glorious. Proverbs 16, 15, or 10 to 15 goes on to say this. The king speaks with divine wisdom. Really? He must never judge unfairly. The Lord demands accurate scales and balances. He sets the standard for fairness. A king detests wrongdoing, for his rule is built on justice. A king is pleased with words from righteous lips. He loves those who speak honestly. The anger of a king is a deadly threat. The wise will try to appease it. When the king smiles, there's life. His favor refreshes like a spring rain. Now, yeah, the king speaks with divine wisdom. That feels a little debatable, you know? Like in America, we don't have a king, right? So we had the No Kings March, and you might have different feelings about the No Kings March, but whatever your feelings about the No Kings March, you're probably not into having a king because Americans aren't, right? Because in our mind, kings tell us we can't do what we want to do. We don't do that here, right? We do presidents, right? But whatever, you could put in anything. You could put in congressman, you could put in president, you could put in boss, you could put in anything at all. And I don't think any of us here would be so bold as to say the person in authority speaks the divine word just because they're there. That's probably not what we would say. But I want to remind you of the good old days. Back when they did, right? Back in the early days of America when they did speak the word of God. Well, you know, maybe not. Okay, maybe not. In the Bible, though, like back in the good old days in the Bible, they were kings and they were godly and they did the right thing every time. And every word that came out of their mouth was as if God had just spoken right through them, right? Peter, what's your problem? You don't agree with that? No, you don't? I mean, haven't you read like 1st and 2nd Kings and Judges and the prophets where it says that, Peter? No, it doesn't say that. No, it doesn't, right? What happened in the Bible is you've got the best King David is painted as not really that good and doing some really bad stuff. And then it's like downhill, utterly downhill from there, right? To where it's like some of these kings are so bad that they're like the antithesis of the word of God. And the prophets are railing against them that God is going to judge them. That's what's happening, right, in the Bible. That's not glory. That's not divine wisdom. So why would the Proverbs say something so untrue, right? I mean, this is the thing that if you're against the Bible being inspired, take this proverb, you know, it feels like false. Well, it's wisdom literature. It's supposed to get you thinking. It's supposed to make you grapple with that. It's supposed to make you dredge up history and look at the facts, right? And that's why it flips back and forth between God and the king. Watch how it works. The king speaks with divine wisdom. He must never judge unfairly. Then it says, the Lord demands accurate scales and balances. He sets the standard for fairness. It flips between the king and the Lord. So the king speaks with divine wisdom, but who decides what divine wisdom is? The Lord. The king's rule is built on justice. Who defines justice? The Lord. So a king is glorious, and the proverb comes true when the king mirrors the Lord, who is the King of Kings. Proverbs 28 says, when a king sits in judgment, he weighs all the evidence, distinguishing the bad from the good. If only they did, right? Again, when mirroring the King of Kings, that proverb comes true. Proverbs 20, 26 to 30. A wise king scatters the wicked like wheat. He runs the threshing wheel over them. This is like a threshing sledge. In a threshing wheel or sledge, the weight of the implement creates a separation between the parts of the wheat. The glory, the weight creates a separation. And then it flips to God. It says, the Lord's light penetrates the human spirit, exposing every hidden motive. Which literally in Hebrew is a rad sentence. I'm just going to give it to you. It's this. The breath of the Lord is Yahweh's lamp, searching through all the rooms of the belly. Which by belly, in the ancient mind, that's where the appetites, the desires come from. And the breath is, in their mind, where life comes from. So think about it this way. By the fact that you're alive, it says, means God is searching your motives. You think you can hide? If you're living, if you have the breath, God's in there looking in every nook and cranny. Then it says, unfailing in love, love and faithfulness protect the king. His throne is made secure through love. The king is dependent on God's love and faithfulness. There's a theme here. For the king to live out any of these statements, he must mirror the King of Kings. 29:13-14 says, the poor and oppressed have this in common. The Lord gives sight to both of their eyes. And here it starts with God as the reference point. I read that and I tend to think, okay, so he doesn't hate oppressors. He doesn't totally hate oppressors. In the ancient world, power tended to mean you had favor from the gods. That was assumed to some degree. And this particular proverb is part of a parallelism where the second line sheds light on the first. The second line switches from God to king. If a king judges the poor fairly, his throne will last forever. In other words, if a king judges the poor fairly, he will be glorious. He'll be like God. So when the poor and oppressor have this in common, that Lord gives sight to both. The surprise in the ancient world was that the poor were looked out for by God. So, okay. The Proverbs also expand beyond the king to all citizens. Proverbs 11:10-11 says this, the whole city celebrates when the godly succeed. They shout for joy when the wicked die. Upright citizens are good for a city and make it prosper. This is kind of a bottom-up vision within the Bible that a prosperous city, one that's built up, happens because people who are godly are succeeding, right? And it sounds dark to celebrate the death of the wicked. I just want to acknowledge that. And both of these are probably hyperbolic, you know, descriptions, because I don't think when a godly person had like a profitable week in their field that they threw a giant party for that, right? And I also don't think that when a evil person died, they literally shouted for joy. It's more like the feeling. So I've got an example for you. Dolly Parton died. Across the world, her songs were played. There was a whole, like a lot of like really great memories, right? Because she'd become known for philanthropy. And generally she was fun and nice. Like if you looked at interviews, fun and nice, right? Dolly Parton. So when she succeeded, she tended to give things away and people were happy, right? Earlier this year, Aldrich Ames died, January 5th. How do you feel? Any thoughts? You do not know who that is. You should, because Aldrich Ames, who died on January 5th, was a CIA officer of the United States who sold secrets to the Soviet Union and the Russians, leading to the death of 10 people who were executed because he ratted them out. Americans. Aldrich Ames. Did anyone shout for joy? Yeah, maybe the families. But do you feel the difference between Dolly Parton and Aldrich Ames? I think that's the point of the proverb. One, you go, who's that? Oh, right? Who's that? Ugh. The other one, you go, yeah. Oh, that's the feel we're getting from the proverb. The point is, the more that godly people succeed, the more they will bless those around them, and the better the nation will be. It's key to say this, the godliness of the successful is not that they claim godliness, but that they do things that other people experience as godliness. That's very important. In Proverbs 29, which I don't have time to go too deeply into, there's the same switch, but we saw God, King, we have King, family. And what that's kind of exhibiting too is that the idea of government we have in the Bible is kind of built off, the first government in the Bible is a family, okay? Anything that's not okay in a family is not okay in a government, therefore. If it's not okay to hate people in your family, if it's not okay for your family to look at your neighbors and burn down their house, the same is true of a government. If you're supposed to respect your mother and father, you're supposed to respect those who are in authority over you. So the locus of power in the Bible derives from God. God is the source. He gives the life breath within us. He's the King of Kings, and all mirroring of the King of Kings exhibits God's power in the world for the good of others. And there seems to be especially an emphasis on those who get overlooked and considered less than, the weak and the poor. What does power look like in the hands of fools? Proverbs 14:34-35 says, "Godliness makes a nation great, but sin is a disgrace to any people. A king rejoices in wise servants, but is angry with those who disgrace him." Okay. This proverb moves from citizen to ruler and then up to God. It's kind of this ascending action. Mirroring God by anyone makes people more great. Any mirroring of God leads to further glory, further greatness. Sin is a disgrace. Now, I want to note, this is not sins. We've talked about this with the kids' catechism a lot. Sin is what? Ponces. Absence of evil. Get more, my definition. Anything short of perfection. Yeah. Sin is not often talked about as individual actions. It's talked about as a big everything outside of perfection. Sin is a disgrace, not only the person who did it here, but to the whole. Because people don't just do things in a vacuum. People do things because they were affected by others. People do things because they're offended by others. People do things because they're afraid of others. People do things because they've grown up in a society that does things. Sin is like a whole encompassing idea. It's not just little things. It's everything that's outside of perfection. So the sin is a part of the community and affects the whole. And the proverb speaks of the king, how they should feel when their citizens are wise or disgraceful. And the natural next step is that since Yahweh is our reference point, that God rejoices when people, especially people who have a lot of authority, mirror his character and ways, and he's angry with those who disgrace him because their rebellion is, not only is it rebellion against him, it's damaging to all those around them. And according to wisdom literature, a person who doesn't live by the order of creation is a fool. A person who doesn't fear the Lord doesn't have the beginning of wisdom. They are a fool. Proverbs 29:2-4 says, "When the godly are in authority, the people rejoice. But when the wicked are in power, they groan. A just king gives stability to his nation, but one who demands bribes destroys it. So when the fool, the wicked, is in power, the people groan. They don't thrive. They experience instability." That's what it says. Now, a quick pause. I assume, since I started with my experience in Montgomery and around slavery, that you could just have a little inkling in your little heart that I am a Democrat and that I'm talking about them, right? Because for some reason, that's how we decided to divide this stuff up. And I just want to, just say, in case you had that little thought in your little heart, I'm just going to say, you're wrong. That is not the point. The point is that these things happened in our country. And I personally don't have a red blue agenda. I really don't care which of those groups wins, okay? And part of why I don't care is I've been paying attention to Jesus for a lot of my life, and I watched him with the groups of his time. And he doesn't seem to particularly care if one of them feels like he's on their team. It just doesn't matter to him. He's dealing with what is godly and not. That's it. And I think that's what we want to look at. In Montgomery, there's a case study. And don't dare take it off the table because it doesn't fit our narrative. But also, on the flip side, don't take other things that other people are concerned about off the table because it doesn't fit another group's narrative. Let's look at what pleases the Lord and what doesn't. Okay? So back to it. Proverbs 29, 12 to 18 states the obvious. If a ruler pays attention to liars, his advisors will be wicked. We've seen that, right? That's pretty rampant. A couple verses later, we have the family examples. To discipline a child produces wisdom, but a mother is disgraced by an undisciplined child. When the wicked are in authority, see, it's going back and forth, family to government. When the wicked are in authority, sin flourishes, but the godly will live to see their downfall. Discipline your children, they will give you peace of mind and will make your heart glad. When people do not accept divine guidance, they run wild. We're back to government. Whoever obeys the laws is joyful. And this is all woven in, like I said, the first government in the Bible is a family. But also, in many ways, we're like children. And what I mean by that is not to diminish us, but to say children need boundaries, rules, and authority. So do I. I need boundaries, rules, and authority. The famous example of this, when is a locomotive of a train most free? When it's on its tracks. When it's on its tracks, right? When it has boundaries, like it's free to do what it was created to do. To know how to use our freedom well, we need these things. Those with power who provide those things are most accountable to God because God is the source of power. Now, okay, there's a lot to this. I could go on and on. So what are nations supposed to do? I'm going to say one piece on this. There's one nation that the Bible is particularly interested in talking to. One nation. Because God is supposed to be at its center. That nation is the nation that God has chosen for himself. Today we would call it the nation that bows before King Jesus. In the Old Testament, they looked forward to a kingdom that was coming. They understood some things about it, some they maybe did not. And we call it Israel generally, the people that wrestle with God. Today, the Apostle Paul says the Israel of God is God's church. Those who believe that Jesus is king and the kingdom has come. And the church is not this. The church is the gathered people of God. The kingdom of God, because Jesus is on the throne, is here, Jesus says, among us, within us. And that kingdom's people are wandering amidst all the idolatrous nations, including the United States of America. They are, in Peter's language, aliens and strangers. And Jesus is their king. And that means that that nation must bear witness to wisdom in the face of foolish power. An example from Montgomery. I sat in a room at one of the parks and watched a documentary. And it was about the march from Selma. And there was a particular moment after the Edmund Pettus Bridge, John Lewis was one of the first people across. He got hit with a billy club by a deputy and was sent to the hospital. So he's in the hospital and he's getting interviewed. And he reiterates what the point of the march was. He said, this is why we did this, to exhibit to the world what we are facing here, the cruelty, and that people will not allow us to access our rights. That is the point, he said. And then older John Lewis commented back on those times. And he said, there was something we could see. There was a particularly mean sheriff in the area, he said. I looked him up. It seems pretty true. And this man had deputized a number of people across that bridge. And why he did that was because the police chief of Selma refused to participate. So he deputized people, various random people, from the community, given them their first uniform and gun and billy club. And John Lewis said, "We knew something about this man. He was a very scared man." He said, "It was very obvious to me how scared he was." And John Lewis said, that's something we can all understand, being afraid. And he said, "Something about us black people getting to vote made him really, really afraid." And so he dug down and got all the power he could get. He deputized all the people who were afraid and took it out on us. That's what happened that day. And you see, foolishness is easy to see if you have eyes, because it leads to disgraceful behavior. Behavior that should make you ashamed of yourself. It causes the weak and the poor to groan. Unfortunately, it's almost always under the guise of being well-intentioned. Very rarely does somebody say, "I'm a fool and I'm scared and I'm going to hit this guy." Normally they say, "I'm defending myself." Right? That's how it works. But it causes instability. It depends on bribes and lies. It's all from the Proverbs we just read. They call that day Bloody Sunday. That's a woman. She's still alive. That man pummeled her. Pummeled a black woman who was in her Sunday best with no defenses. That is foolish. That is evil. That is easy to see. You can watch the video. It's pre-AI. I can guarantee it's actually real. You can watch the pummeling of these people. You can see it. You can judge using your eyes and using your ears. Power can be utilized by fools. Fools use power to achieve safety and security without trusting in the Lord or fearing the Lord. It's like the Old Testament. When kings came into the picture, why'd they come into the picture? Because the people of Israel looked around at the other nations and they said, they have strong people that make them feel more secure and less afraid. And God said to them, "This isn't going to go well for you." And they wanted it. And so God gave them kings. It's the same thing. I want to feel better. I want to feel safe. I want to feel secure. I don't want to have to believe that God's going to take care of me. That is scary. So we take power in our hands like a fool. So what does the wise use of power look like? Proverbs 11:10a and 14 says, "The whole city celebrates when the godly succeed," skipping ahead a little bit. "Without wise leadership, a nation falls. There's safety in having many advisors." The word here for leadership means someone who steers, like steers a ship. People are steered by their leaders, right? If wisdom comes from fearing the Lord, which is the thesis of Proverbs, then power is good when it mirrors the King of Kings, and the best of leaders steer people to fear the Lord. We must not confuse, like ancient Israel did, feeling strong and safe and stable with godliness. You see, when the ancient Israelites wanted a king, they wanted to feel strong and safe and stable. When that man beat that woman with a club, he wanted to feel strong and safe and stable. Those are not things you shouldn't want. Everyone wants those. But people who believe in God believe those things come under the King of Kings. Not when we come out from under the King of Kings and take it into our own hands. And that's really important when we think about how we bring power to bear in public. There are a couple lines in Proverbs 29 that seem too good to be true. 14 and 16, "If a king judges the poor fairly, his throne will last forever." Okay, like when has that ever happened, right? Whose kingdom has really lasted forever? "It feels like good rulers." This is how it feels to me anyway. I mean, can you imagine, like, all the election ads are going? do you know somebody who's just actually really humble and like a good person? Can you imagine them trying to like campaign? Like just, what if they just got up there and they actually just said, I really think we should do this. I'm not 100% sure because I've been wrong before, but I think it'd be really smart and I'd really love to listen to your input. Like that campaign ad fails, right? Like it just immediately, apparently. It feels like you don't win because those who win get loud, bully people, cheat, and, you know, are crooks or at least defame the opposition. That's the best of the best. Just defame the opposition, right? That's how it feels. It doesn't feel like the king who judges the poor fairly, will their throne will last forever. 16 goes on to say, when the wicked are in authority, sin flourishes, but the godly will live to see their downfall. I mean, is that how it works? Is that really true? That they'll flourish in their sin, but you'll see it all come undone. Right? It doesn't always feel so true. I told you I was going to bring Carolyn back up, who we met in Montgomery, and she was so sweet. She just took so many times out to just sit and talk with me, and she lived in Montgomery when it was segregated. She had lived through the era of the bus lockout. She had lived through some of these events in the 60s and the 50s. And she'd lived through a period where it felt like they had really made some great strides, right? Or it felt like things had really changed. And it felt like they'd seen some of the foolishness of the laws that excluded and divided black and white Americans from one another to come apart. The chili dog place where I went, first business in Montgomery to hire an African American. It still had the wall up. They had to have walls by law where the blacks would sit on one side so the whites couldn't see them. That wall was still there in the chili dog place, not because they believed it, but just so you'd remember. But she saw the chili dog spot, Chris's Chili Dogs, stand up and say, that's it. We'll hire somebody. No more. She saw that change, right? But to this day, Montgomery remains one of the most divided places politically. You drive down the freeway, the Confederate flags are flying, which means to them, there's some people that want it to go back to the way it used to be, right? And the constant reminder, the Confederate monuments are all still standing. And you go to King's Church, and what you see at King's Church is the steps are kind of falling apart and... actually, like the roof's in bad shape. His house's roof's getting redone. The church isn't looking so good. But the Capitol's in tip-top shape, and old Jefferson Davis is standing tall in front. That's what you see right now. The historic black neighborhoods have declined, actually. There's a lot of poverty and crime. There's a lady, a Latina lady, in our group, and she was really cautious. She didn't want to trip any wires, but she said, I don't want to say the wrong thing, but she's like, I'm watching in the old videos, these people were like so passionate and they were in their Sunday best and they're standing up for things. Like, why not now? Like, why is everybody not doing that now? And Larry, one of our other guides, he said, well, some people gave up hope. Some people gave up hope. But others have not. All the sites I went to watch by a group of lawyers, one of them who was on the TV, he said, when I saw the bus boycotts and I saw that this is a legal issue, I decided I was going to go to the best law school and work my tail off and do something about this. And he is. And he's part of the team that's like why these sites are standing today. They've raised, not only have they done such a good job in court, they've raised so much money, they've bought up like 10% of Montgomery. They've just been buying it. And they're like, we're going to remember our story here. Carolyn hasn't given up either. She's still working. And she's bringing people under King Jesus. Because King Jesus is still good. even though some have lost hope. King Jesus is still on the throne, even though some have lost hope. King Jesus' kingdom is secure, even though some have lost hope. And so as we sang a hymn in our final moments together in Montgomery, she just started to cry. And I don't think it's because she's without hope. I think she's holding on to a hope that feels too good to be true. Holding on to a hope that seems too good to be true. What do I mean by that? It's like the proverb, will I see the downfall of the wicked? The flip side of it, will I see the godly enthroned forever? Can it be? And sometimes when you hold hope, you weep because you see all of the brokenness that still exists. But she was with a room of people who spent a day with her and listened. And it made her weep. So how do we mirror the power of God in our world today? It's right there in the Proverbs. We steer. We lead. And those Proverbs talked about citizens. It didn't just talk about kings. It talked about everyday people. It talked about citizens. It talked about families. It starts with you. It starts with ourselves. It starts with our church. It starts with our family. It starts with people deciding, I'm going to come under the rule of King Jesus. And I'm going to exhibit to those who I meet what the rule of King Jesus feels like. I'm going to do my best. And when I don't, I'm going to receive the grace of Jesus and I'm going to get back up and I'm going to try to come under his rule again. That's what the grace is for. The grace isn't a get off free card. It's a you can keep walking with me because I forgive you card. The moment when Jesus exhibits his power in the world, think about that, was profound because he stood before the foolish, right? Go read the story of his trial, his arrest, right? The crucifixion. They mustered all the power they could get, right? They clubbed him, right? They mocked him. Why? Because the various parties of Judaism, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, you got the zealots, right? They were afraid. They were afraid their whole society was getting lost and that the Romans conquering them was going to, you know, obliterate them eventually. They chose very different ways to deal with their fear, but they were afraid. And then there were the Romans. They were afraid. How do I know they were afraid? Because you don't snuff out somebody who claims to be a king if that doesn't worry you. If it didn't worry you, you would just go away. But you assert your power when you're afraid. They had a lot of things that made them stable, and they didn't want to lose those. For the Jews, it was their temple, their strong society, their history, right? The temple. In Rome, it was the Caesars, their powerful leaders who they deified, who said they bring the power of the gods to bear here. Folks, that temple of the Jews got knocked down by the Romans. And the temples of the Romans are on display as tourist attractions. Right? Those things did not stay stable. They did not protect. They did not endure. But King Jesus seems to have never fallen off of his throne, it turns out. Even though his way often leads us through suffering and an experience of needing to trust in the Lord. But his kingdom remains, and it's cropping up all over the world. And when Jesus came to that cross, he entrusted himself to his Father, who has the power over death. And that is power, even if it feels too good to be true. As we follow Jesus, we're called to come back under that power and to trust in him. We move into our three final rhythms of worship. confess, receive, and offer. Under confession, it'd be a great moment for me, I assume for you, to ask, what is it that I think makes me stable? What is it that I think gives me power? Just try to name it. And, you know, when I feel unstable, when I feel afraid, what do I do? There's your clue. Where do I run? What do I do? Bring that before God. That's the first step, admitting you have a problem, right? Then receive. If you can admit you have a problem, you can come to the cross and plead his mercy and receive his power. What did Jesus say to his disciples, right? You will receive power when the Holy Spirit comes upon you. Okay, and you will be my witnesses. You get a power that's from a kingdom greater than any of the kingdoms of this world. So come to him, receive what he has to offer to you, what you can't do yourself. Receive it from him and try coming under his kingship. And in offer, we go back to the table in the back. Now, what better way to declare which kingdom you belong to than by renouncing trusting in your money? To Garrett's point recently, right? And to name on that window back there, what could it look like for me to turn from what I trust in and come under King Jesus? If you can come up with a word for that, write it on the window. Let's try to name something this week. As we come to the table, we remember that on the night that Jesus was betrayed, he broke bread and he said, "This is my body broken for you. Every time you do this, remember me." And we need to remember what that breaking looked like. It looked hopeless. It looked like the kingdoms of this world were defeating him. He said, "This is my blood shed for the forgiveness of many, a new covenant." And so what he's declaring is like what would happen when they watched him on the cross and the blood shed comes down and they reflected on that, they realize he is defeating sin and death in his suffering, right? And he invites you to remember that. Remember a kingdom, a covenant, a promise that was bought by his blood. And every time we do that, we don't just remember that he died. We remember that God raised him from the dead victorious and that his kingdom will reign forever and ever. I'm going to pray and leave us 2 minutes of silence for confession. Father, this is hard to believe. It's hard to believe that we could rely on anything other than our typical power structures that lead us into foolish, hateful behavior. That feels like the only thing that works out there. And we need your help to have faith. We need your help and your spirit to give us power that we can stand as citizens of your kingdom and put our hope in you. So as we come before you and confess, give us eyes to see the foolishness of our hearts so that we can humble ourselves and receive the power of your spirit. So lead us now as we pray.